you never really understand the pieces in play unless you've got some experts that you can really, you know, have helping you. Because, you know, you can't do this business by just acquiring or just being a capital raiser or just being good on the operation. You've got to have people that can help you.
Welcome to The Lead Sponsor, where we bring you exclusive access to the most successful and sought-after real estate syndication sponsors in the industry. Join us as we dive deep into the stories, strategies, struggles, and secrets of these elite professionals who are changing the game in commercial real estate investing. Whether you're an active sponsor looking to take your business to the next level, or a passive investor looking for the best operators in the country, the Lead Sponsor Podcast is for you. And now, your host, David T. Robinson.
Hey guys, David Robinson here. Welcome to the Lead Sponsor Podcast. I've got Andy McMullen from Legacy Acquisitions with me today. Andy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for having me on, David. Appreciate it, man.
So what the guests don't know is that I totally just botched the intro. This is our second time through and I blew it. So thanks for being gracious and letting me to back up and redo that. But really excited to have you on the show, Andy. And you know, as we do with all of our guests, we want to sort of get a clear picture of what your business looks like today. So if you can, just describe what Legacy Acquisitions is all about and we can go from there.
Yeah, sure. Thanks again, David. So basically, Legacy was formed, you know, about 2014 or so, and then kind of rebranded 2018 to really focus more on the built-to-rent part of, you can call it horizontal multifamily. We can get in a little bit more in the specifics, but basically what we're doing is we're acquiring raw pieces of land, let's just say in that 30-acre range. We will go through the entitlement process, get all the hearings with the neighborhood council, the mayor, the city, get the project approved, then we will purchase the land. So we get all of that done out in the option period, purchase the land, then do the engineering, environmental, and then we'll start kind of the streets, roads, utilities, which is what we call the horizontal process mm-hmm. development. And that's about 6 to 9 months. And then we go vertical. So built to rent in the sense is if you can think of building homes next to each other and managing them exactly like we would our multifamily assets.
Yeah, I'm super intrigued by this concept. It's something that I'm less familiar with. And so I'm excited to have this conversation with you today. But to talk, to get a little bit more detail about Legacy Acquisitions. So in the Legacy Acquisitions was under a different name in 2014, rebranded in 2018. When did you start focusing on the build-to-rent model?
Probably about then. Maybe 2019. I had met a couple of partners that we had worked before, just kind of investing in each other's deals. And then, you know, Andrew G is a partner in our deals. He's a founder of Mad Capital. And then Derek Alexandrenko had been building a lot of these smaller homes in, you know, clusters of 10 to 20 to 30. Mm. And then he kind of partnered up with myself and Andrew so that we had, it could scale the operation. And so that's kind of when we started doing this 2018. Our partner, our boots on the ground, has been doing this probably since, 2012, 2013. You know, we called it different. You kind of remember what happened in 2008. Yeah, you're a lot younger than me, but you kind of understand that the music just kind of stopped. And so those same people that had kind of maybe made billions of dollars on, you know, the commercial are now basically packaging up all these homes that were, you know, set up as scatter sites. So you might have, you know, American Homes for Rent or Goldman. Those guys were just basically buying up, you know, for 50 cents on the dollar in a county, in one county, and then trying to manage those properties and scatter sites. And then at some point, you know, we kind of figured out collectively, why not we just build these next to each other? We do have, you know, a 4 million unit, you know, depending on who you talk to, dearth of units now. Why don't we build them and manage them like multifamily? So that's when it started to become kind of, you know, Wall Street's favored son. And when we started to say, hey, look, if we can build things where there's potential exit strategies at each phase, then it makes sense for us to go in some of these secondary and tertiary markets where we're seeing a lot of growth. You know, the family dynamic is strong, the schools are strong, topography is, you know, is favorable. And then most important, the, you know, municipalities are development friendly, which I'm in San Diego, been in LA most of my life. Obviously, it's a completely different game as far as how you interact with, you know, those people around you in municipalities that you're developing in.
And so one of your business partners has extensive experience in that space, you know, starting in the, you know, boots on the ground, 2012, roughly. You guys form the business as it looks like today in 2018, 2019, and really start to hone in on this build to rent model. You mentioned your two other partners. I'm curious, just from a personnel structure and a division of responsibilities, you have the three principles of legacy acquisitions. Can you maybe just share with us sort of how you guys are structured from a personnel and a responsibility standpoint?
So every deal is set up as its own entity. So, you know, legacy would be one owner, and that's basically my company. We've got about 10 people in our group. Hammerhead Capital is kind of on the acquisition phase and the construction phase. That would be Derek Alexandrenko and Chris Font. You know, Chris Vaughn and Derek have been doing acquisitions with a lot of the institutions before they started even working on their projects. So just a ton of experience there. And then Andrew G brings, you know, 25 years of counsel and experience. So he helps us on the asset management side. So really legacy's role, and I've been in development, you know, since, I don't know, early aughts probably is kind of where we would start. And then, you know, obviously, totally changed in 28. The market really didn't come back till 2012. So then we started doing, you know, multifamily deals for the most part in California. But as a kind of structure, which might be helpful for people to think about, you know, our boots on the ground handle the acquisition, you know, mayor, council members, getting everything set up, and then the construction build. Legacy manages the capital, accounting, legal, managing the property manager, so the asset management angle. So that's kind of how we divvy up responsibilities. And then we, of course, have JV partners outside of that kind of core that come in with various roles and expertise. But that's typically how we've been structuring our deals.
So the three different, you know, key parties involved are separate entities, but you guys all partner together on a particular project. Am I understanding
correct.
It correctly?
A true JV in that.
Got it.
So, you know, just imagine, you know, you, David, bring, you know, your experience. We've known each other for a while, invested each other's deals. And then,
right.
I've got basically this opportunity for us to help us scale. You've got this set of skills that really doesn't have the kind of experience in the capital raising side, but would really love to continue the construction side, because that's what we've been doing for years. So that's why the
understood works makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad that we're having you on to be able to sort of dissect this a little bit. So let's just talk about just your portion of the business model.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And maybe just talk to us about your specific role in your specific business. You know, a lot of these businesses can be very lean. In fact, there's many just one key principle in each entity. For you, is that what this looks like? What does your particular business look like?
Yeah, I would say, I listen to a lot of pods, including yours. I love it. I would say the best thing that I've done in this business over the years, honestly, and maybe learning this at early age, is, and this may sound trite because everybody says it, but when you have fewer skills like I did at a certain stage, when you're younger in the business or you're trying to figure this out, you don't have all the technology, you don't have the access to, you know, experts and pods, is that I've always kind of been able to build out a team of really smart, you know, talented people. Certainly it's a check to your ego often, right? Because you're often the dummy. But for me, I like to be surrounded by a team that's got, you know, multiple years of experience on scaling businesses. So one of our chief, our COO of Legacy Acquisitions, Pete Vanderveen, has been a VP at Exxon for multiple years. He's founded multiple companies. Ruben Greth, who I think you know, is our partner. He's, you know, that capital raiser show. It's a million, I think, you know, maybe not as much as yours, but a million, 1.5 million downloads, right? So he's doing pretty well. So he brings in kind of a different, you know, marketing skill set. And then, so we've got, you know, again, a couple admin people that really, if I lost them, the business would be completely defunct. So that's kind of how I like to do it. So we're about 8 to 10 deep, depending on, you know, admin people and outside. And my role is really as the kind of CEO role, bringing in capital, making sure that I'm kind of leading from the bottom up, getting them everything that we need for the processes and the systems to work, and then overseeing kind of how does the underwriting fit with what we're trying to go after? How does the systems in place, do they allow us to report the way that we should to investors? And are we able to give that what we call elite service or white glove service to not only the members that are raising with us, the JV partners, but obviously the investors? So my role specifically is kind of from the bottom, helping all the smarter people do their thing.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, perfect. Well, thanks for giving us that overview. Let's go back a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, you've been in this business for a very long time, you know, over 20 years.
Yeah.
You've been through another cycle, doing deals in a different way back then. And then after, you know, 2012, starting to focus on multifamily. But let's back up a little bit.
Yeah.
And let's talk about your journey forward to where you're at today. How have you gotten to this point?
Yeah. So I would say, son of a basketball coach and a substitute teacher, obviously, I think two of the most important things in real estate business in general, right, is the kind of discipline, work ethic, right, character, integrity, those kinds of things. But we were spent most of our lives in debt, really, right? And by their own admission, they didn't know, you know, how to manage the money. And so I certainly, when I got to college and, you know, paying my way from college, I kind of figured out that I was going to be in debt for a long time as well. But I had a really close friend in at school. I went to school in Los Angeles, and, you know, he was working for this boutique company real estate firm called Pacifica Capital Group. And when I came out of school, so I guess it's much longer than 20 years now, it's getting closer to 25, really. You know, most of my friends were kind of going on becoming consultants or paper millionaires up in Northern California. And I had always kind of been fascinated by the real estate game. So I came in, started working on the brokerage side, which was like office buildings, boutique office buildings and industrial buildings and some mixed use projects. And then I kind of started to understand that most of what their business was investing in these value add assets and collecting checks. Well, I'm pounding the phones and, you know, sitting in my car wondering where's my next check come from. I'd, you know, go into the office and they'd be sliding these Irwindale Fund 5, right? And they had these just checks coming in. I'm like, I got to get on that side. So now in this market, maybe some people are like, I got to get on the broker side, right? You got multiple deals. But back then, I really kind of became fascinated by how everything fit together by the property management, the asset management, the acquisition, the underwriting, you know, what skill did I have? And most of my skill set had to be with building strong teams and working well with people, and then kind of being able to synthesize from a high level. I'm more of a generalist from a high level. What makes sense? So I tell people, you're probably not old enough to remember Mr. Magoo, but I kind of Magooed my way into it, where like I'm just going along and everything. So I'm knocking everything over, but I'm somehow able to kind of just basically skate out of it, you know, without too much damage. Obviously, tons and tons of failures along the way. You don't get to this point without having some real losers. But that's a little bit about my story. Probably a lot longer than you care to hear. But
no, I love it. That's great. So you were in this brokerage business and you decided, hey, I need to get on the other side of the aisle here. How did you make that transition to the other side of the aisle?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing is that when you're in the brokerage business, you do create a lot of relationships with other developers, with you know, I had, I was lucky in the sense that I was working as a broker for brokers that they were, they're now investors that were once brokers. And they said, hey, look, you know, you can build this business, learn it, and then start buying into our deals. Like it was one of those boutiques in the same way that we allow our people, you know, they don't have to come in with their 50,000. They can come in with whatever they got. If they want to get in the real estate game on some of our deals, they've got that opportunity to do so. So I was really blessed in that way with, you know, some people that did care about whether, and I think you would agree, David, I mean, you know, I'm sure you've talked about your mentors, but you know, there's people along the way that you could have never got to where you are without their help. So I think the big change for me was when I started working for a developer. His name was Bob D'Elia, and he was developing a lot of Venice Beach. And he since passed away early. But really, what I learned from that was just his ability to be, you know, with extreme character, be able to kind of synthesize the information, take great care of his people. And he also had, you know, a life outside. It wasn't just about, he loved it. He loved it and he wanted to be here. But he kind of really instilled a lot of the belief. I had a lot of self-doubt like everybody does. I still have self-doubt. If we don't say we have self-doubt, we're probably lying to ourselves. But we kind of figure out a way to push through it, right? But he really kind of had a belief in me. And as a result, he was able to put me in a lot of rooms with, you know, the iStars of the world and the McFarlands of the world, and really underwriting properties and trying to figure out how we could get the debt and equity piece. And, you know, 2006, 7, and 8 was just, you know, destruction, right? The music stopped for everybody. So you had to figure out a way to scramble and preserve these properties that he had developed out of, you know, his bare hands, you know. So that was probably, I think, an inflection point that I think about for me.
And then after the market shifted and was starting to recover, let's call it 2012, what did your world look like? What were you involved in? What were you focused on?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, yeah, my mentor that I mentioned, he passed away in 2010, early of brain cancer. And so his wife and I, we kind of started to look at other opportunities in the area. And so we were kind of managing, you know, smaller multifamily projects. We were looking at a couple of hotel conversions. You know, if you remember, the market really didn't come back, honestly, until 2012. So from 2009, 10, 11, you're kind of getting in wherever right. You could fit in, right? So, you know, various forms of deals here, you had to be very creative. Luckily, the area that we were working on in Venice does have a lot of the kind of retail that bleeds into the, you know, live workspace, that bleeds into the multifamily. So we had opportunities, but it wasn't really until 2012 where I felt, hey, now it's coming back. We can get the financing that seems more favorable. There's some other areas that I'd like to explore. Central California was one of them, Southern California. And the only reason that we're working in the Southeast now is because, you know, rent control was enacted 2019, and then it just made sense for us to go Southeast. But yeah, so I mean, it's hard to remember that. Like, I'm sure I woke up.
I'm taking you back.
I'm sure I woke up many days from like 2012 and be like, you know, what am I doing? But
yeah. How did things progress from there? You started to explore other markets, you know, outside of Venice. You started to explore other asset types and opportunities. How did things progress up to, you know, roughly, you know, 2018 when you really started to hone in on the build to rent?
Yeah, I would say, you know, really what I became pretty good at is the acquisition process. So finding the deals, talking to the brokers, a lot of that stuff, some of the stuff in Central California was just, you know, owner, just us to owner, trying to find, you know, good opportunities. Maybe we would bring them in to the property. Then we started kind of building out these syndications. I had done a couple of syndications earlier in Dallas and a couple of other places, but not to the extent where I really felt like I kind of understood all the pieces in play. And I didn't understand, you never really understand the pieces in play unless you've got some experts that you can really, you know, have helping you, because, so, you know, you can't do this business by just acquiring or, you know, just being a capital raiser or just being good on the operation. You've got to have people that can help you. So we started buying some stuff in Fresno, buying some stuff in San Diego where I was, some stuff in LA that we had. And every deal, as you know, is different. But if I'm trying to create like a through line for your listeners, it was a lot of follow-up, which seems so trite and simple. But I just want to dig into this for a second, David, because I think it's so important. I have this habit tracker that I use, and I use it very regularly. And it seems kind of dumb, right? You know, the 10 to 12 things that you want to do. You want to do your family walks, and you have your hobbies that you want to do. And you kind of look at this each day. You're like, oh, there's no way I'm going to get it done. And you become discouraged, right? But we overestimate what we can do in a day. But we really, really, really underestimate what we can do in a quarter or a year. We have a bad day, we come back the next. So what I really started to figure out is, like, I can be a little less harsh on me and my team by this thing or that thing if we can kind of create a consistency on the follow-up and the systems. And that's honestly where I felt like we were getting 5-6 good deals a year, because, you know, oftentimes you're not going to hear from somebody, but if you got a system and following up. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because I know that there's a lot of people less experienced than you or I that are listening to these podcasts and are thinking, where do I fit in? Almost every single person that's listening, you know, stop your dishes a second. You know, if a dummy like, and I always say, if I can give one gift to my team, it's like, hey, look at me, I'm a dummy, and look what we've been able to do, right? Like, there's somewhere for you to just break through your fear. You're going to be able to find a, you know, place on a team to perform. So that sounds easy. It certainly is simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And that is helpful. I think, you know, everybody's got limiting beliefs in their own mind, in their own head. And it takes mentors, and it takes a team, and it takes, you know, developing those daily habits that lead to the end result that you're trying to achieve. So walk us forward to how you formed the partnership with who you're partnering with today. How did those relationships come together? And then I want to dive into a particular case study on a deal you're working on, a build-to-rent community.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I'm part of a mastermind, Kingdom REI. And I met, you know, my partners at this mastermind. We met quite, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. And we were kind of talking constantly about how do we do this or that. And it just became a pretty quick realization that you know, a lot of the things that we were working on could really benefit not just us, but the entire group. You know, as people have been part of masterminds, there's people that you know that are going to really help build your business. But why do we need to keep reinventing the wheel when there could be things that were you know, are complementary? So so about 2018, you know, I started to figure out that this is where I could be completely wrong, but it just made logical sense to me at the time.
And you, like, I mean, you were, there's a lot of talk about build to rent now, but you know, that's really just been in the last, at least from my perspective, only in the last maybe 12 to 18 months. So you're really early on this, you know, trend into the build to rent space.
Yeah. And again, I'm a good into it, right? Like Derek, my partner, has been doing this. I recognize this, there's a true talent here. And well, let's just look at it. Like, we've seen suburbanization going on for many, many years, even before COVID, right? We've seen that we haven't built any housing, apartments or single family, for 10 years, right? Not many. And we know that there's going to be 3 million more millennials coming into the kind of home creation phase. We know that they don't care about the American dream in the same way that I did, you know, where you own a house, you fix it up. You know, I think I had my son in 2010. We had this old beater that we would fix up, et cetera. You could buy a business if you want, or a part of a business on your phone, right? So I don't think that's the same, you know, value to them. They want new stuff and technology that started to make sense at the time, which was people are living longer. So why, and they're probably not going to senior living as early as we originally anticipated, but But they certainly don't want to do anything other than change the light bulb. They want to have their backyard and their barbecue and their doggy door and all that, but they certainly don't, you know, want to be put out to pasture too early, right? So I kind of felt like those things made sense to me, that we would have some run. And then just a lot of it's luck too, right? As you know, David, like I had friends who are already working at American Home for Rent, and you know, they'd been doing, you know, but like I thought, what a dumb name for the longest time. Like, why would you want to work there? But they've been just killing it for years, right? So a lot of those things kind of came into focus. And then, you know, when I was hearing about what Derek was doing with kind of going into areas where there's growth, where there's young families, you know, whether it's, you know, young couples or families, and where there's just a lot of good schools, elementary, because most of them are young schools. So that's kind of how it came to fruition. And as you know, a lot of this stuff is just kismet, right? It's luck.
Well, this is great. So let's dive into this particular project that you're working on, Crest Build to Rent Community. Let's just start at a high level. Where's this one located? And what is this community, where's this at in the development stage? And what will this look like when it's complete?
Yeah, so Crest BTR is, we've basically been, I'd say for the last 2 years, working on this project. So we go through the acquisition phase, you get everything approved by the city. Again, you wanna be in a municipality that's very development friendly. Then we start to lay down all of the infrastructure, or what we call horizontal. So we would go to the streets, the utilities, the sewer, you know, a pond, right? We want to have in Lafayette, you know, you want to have, it's not in a flood zone, you know, which some people expect Louisiana would, all the properties would be in a flood zone. So there certainly took some education there. But, you know, we want to have a dog park. We want to have walking trails. We want to have a playground. But really what we're trying to do is keep it very simple in this particular market. In other markets, you'll have the clubhouse or the pool. We're working on some larger projects. But in this one, pretty simple, 1,200 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2 baths, high vaulted ceilings. And anybody that's curious, they can go on our site and see some of the ones that we've already built and some of our renderings of what we will build. So we've basically built 8 of the 98 that we'll be building. And so we've got all of those rented. Certainly, you know, costs have changed a little bit. I think, you know, concrete's gone up. The lumber came down kind of from when we started underwrite. We benefited, luckily, from rents that are much higher than our pro forma, and maybe a little bit of drop in labor, which is a big part of the development, because, you know, you got fewer home builders, you know, are building actually homes to sell. So that's kind of the thinking there. And so we should be building about 10 a month here, really in March. We've had some weather issues, so we might be a little bit delayed, but we should be about 6 to 10 a month. I think 6 in our underwriting, 10 is kind of a little more realistic. And then we, you know, we'll be stabilizing them. That's one of the beauties, I think, of Built to Rent, is that as soon as you've got one built, you got a CFO, you know, a certificate of occupancy, you can get the tenant in or the resident in right away. You're not waiting for the entire project to be built. You know, we can have a model unit, you know, that basically is separate with its own backyard, et cetera. And then the other thing that I really like about is to kind of, I was told not to use the word sticky, like it, you know, sounds like, you know, it's beneath the residents, but it means that the tenants are staying a little bit longer, because if you do have these community events that we've have, and you do have the backyard, and you know your neighbors, you know, the people stay a little bit longer, and it's new, right? You could, you know, your phone. I get too excited about it, man. I'll let it breathe, and then you can ask the question.
No, I appreciate it. I'm curious. So I got a handful of questions here. So just from a, you know, the product type perspective, just most of our listeners are fairly sophisticated investors, been in the business. But for those that may be less familiar, I mean, the 98 units, these are individual single family homes, all on one level, correct? Yeah. 3-bed, 2-bath, did you say?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And I believe I've seen, maybe I've seen some images that Ruben or you have put out. I mean, these are pretty modern looking finishes, correct? So like concrete floors, concrete countertops, high vaulted ceilings. Am I understanding? Am I thinking of the right thing?
Yeah, no, you're dead on. I mean, the idea is, and this is again, you know, as we've iterated, we kind of, you know, are following trends. And certainly this is something that Derek, before he partnered with us, was building these kind of on a smaller scale. And he was doing a lot of the early management too. So you would kind of know here's what people want, here's what they don't want. And what people really care about is a good sized backyard, really kind of newer finishes. You know, we're putting in some of the prop tech. Some of these units will have the prop tech, and then they really want to have the kind of amenities. And that could be simple amenities. Like I said, we're not building out a clubhouse or a pool, but they've got, you know,
walking trails, dog park, playgrounds.
So, you know, really simple stick build, all the same interiors. So that makes it really efficient for us to build quickly. Different elevations, different exteriors. So when you drive through the neighborhood, you'll have different color homes and you'll have different funnels and porch layout. But essentially, it's a 1,200 foot. It looks a lot bigger when you get in it because of the vaulted ceilings and the way that they're laid out. But yeah, pretty simple build.
And they're pretty compact, right? I mean, what's the, you know, setback from structure to structure, side by side?
I mean, yeah, you're talking about zero lot lines, right? So you're, you know, you've got your enough land on each side, but you know, some of them we can't get windows right on the side yard, right? Because there's zero lot line. So you gotta create light and space on some of the other areas. So
got it.
But fencing, are all
the units individually fenced?
They are, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they are. And so you do have, you know, that privacy. You know, and again, we're just think of it like horizontal multifamily. So we're managing it like we would, you know, our other multifamily projects.
Sure.
You know, we'll let them do with the backyards and we'll have something in place if it becomes too unruly, but we're maintaining all the landscaping and everything else like we would our multifamily projects.
And when you're, and when you say, you know, a decent sized backyard, I mean, we're talking what, maybe
Some of them are larger than others because of the way that they're laid out, but I would say, you know, 20 foot, you know, backyard. So you've got some space there for your dog and, you know, enough space to
put some patio.
I'm in San Diego in California. In Venice, we would have these 10 foot little balconies. So that seems big to me, but yeah, they're, you know, decent size.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then who's your typical or your ideal tenant in these? You mentioned maybe trying to cater to the millennial, you know, younger demographic, but then you also mentioned the older demographic. So who's the ideal tenant for these communities?
I think a young family is our ideal. I mean, there's a lot in that particular area. There's a healthcare. There's a lot of oil and gas still. There's, you know, teachers. We've got a couple of teachers in there. So yeah, I would say kind of the young, either young married couples or younger families, you know, that's typically who we've been kind of marketing these towards. Now in Broussard, which is 20 minutes away, we'll be building, you know, 241 units. That tenant is going to, there's going to be a little more upscale. It's probably going to be a little bit more expensive there. Maybe the rents are, instead of $1,700 a month in Lafayette, maybe there'll be some threes and four bedrooms where we're getting up in those twos, 2,200, 2,300 with pools and clubhouse. So each market's a little bit different, but this particular one, yeah, we kind of felt like we could basically kind of cater to some of the younger families there that could maybe potentially buy a home at some point. You know, they have to, you know, three times rent. I think that's worth mentioning, David, just in general.
I was just going to ask about that. I'm curious, like, what's the rents? What's your target rents for each one of these units? And then what's the corresponding, you know, single family home, you know, payment? So anyways, maybe shed some light on that.
Yeah. So we, in our places, we want 2.5 to 3 times the rent, right, for their income. So in other words, you know, if there's been some projects in the multifamily space where we were, you know, maybe okay with two, but I think in general, one thing that really I could never anticipated is this affordability gap just keeps growing, right? Over the last year, you mentioned 12 months. And so, you know, as a result, I think nationwide, we're about $900 more for your mortgage than to rent out your place. Now that doesn't mean that there won't be some stagnant rents. I think if I'm everything that I'm reading, I think we probably will have a real drop in rents. Nominally will be up maybe percent, but with inflation at 6 or 7, there's definitely going to be kind of some some regulation on the rents. But yeah, typically we're able to get that three times. And I think that's important. You know, historically, you know, rents to income have been kind of in that 33%. So people were paying, you know, 33% of their income on rent. I think now we've dropped that down a little bit. We're still in that 28% range. So that's kind of another metric where I feel that there's still pretty reasonable, you know, chance that we're going to have retention on those residents.
You mentioned, you know, from start to finish, this has been about 2 years in the making so far. When do you think the project will be completed?
Yeah, so,
and fully stabilized?
I think we'll be completed this year. So, you know, by this calendar year, I'm expecting that we'll be stabilized. I'm accounting for two quarters after that. I think, as I said before, we can lease a lot as we go. And as we build, it will be easier.
We've got
a lot of units and we've got some things happening there. But I think you got to be a little conservative on the actual stabilization, because there's just things that can happen. There's delays, weather delays. There's a number of things. We try to strip out as much risk as we can in each transition. So, for example, if you're an investor coming in one of our deals, you're coming in, you know, you can either come in before where it's raw land, there's no entitlements, right? And there's a lot of risk there because anything can happen. You come in after the entitlements, but before the streets, roads, and utilities are done. So with each kind of stage, we can either decide to exit and sell it to somebody else, or, you know, new investors can come in at that stage. So there is some kind of flexibility in the development. There's obviously a lot of risk too, but if we can strip away some of the risk and, you know, execute on the plan, then obviously some of that can be adjusted.
And to stay focused on this particular project, Crest in Lafayette, Louisiana, from a capital raising standpoint, you started, I'm assuming you started raising equity on this for the original acquisition, you know, roughly 2 years ago. And then you continue to raise along the way. How does the capital raising portion of this model work?
Well, I would say, yeah, it's a great question. This you kind of hit on maybe a special case in a sense. We had actually raised all the capital. This is kind of a sign of the times, right? We'd raised all the capital. I had signed the loan documents, right? And the next day after I signed the loan documents, my bank calls and said, "Hey, really sorry, man, but you know, Goldman Sachs, we have this warehouse line with Goldman Sachs, and they really think that your LTC is too high, and so we're gonna drop you another 5 points, right? So now you got to go out and you got to raise more, right? And then you got to go back to your investors and explain why. Now, for the investor, there's a safety net there, and then it's a little bit less, you know, loan to cost, but you also have more capital that's coming in, so." That's an example of a kind of sign of the times. Now, I imagine, you know, any of the deals that we're underwriting, we're not seeing 75% loan to cost. We're seeing 65%, and now, you know, a mezz piece. But you were asking just kind of about the raise strategy. We can raise at each stage. So if you imagine during the kind of entitlement period, we're trying to close on the land, right? Because we option it. Get the entitlements done. Now we'll close on the land. We're closing on a project next week. So that might cost us $2 million for the land, right? And then we know that's going to be another couple hundred thousand for engineering, environmental. And then 6 months later, we're going to start the streets, roads, and utilities. So we're going to need, you know, maybe we'll get a $6 million, $7 million loan from a bank. And then we're going to need to raise another $2, $3 million, right? And then 9 months after that, we're going to need to have all of our capital for the vertical build in place. So at each stage, there's kind of, you know, we could raise all the way through, and we've been talking about activating our fund that we have to do these deals a little bit more seamlessly. But this is how we decided to do these deals, which is a single syndication.
And you did the all the required equity all up front.
Yeah, so all the required equity for our Lafayette project up front, exactly.
Got
and,
it.
And the way that that typically works with a bank, like we, our partner is one of the largest debt firms, so debt funds in the country. So what they want is basically you come in with your equity, you're exhausting your equity, right? Before you got, you get the loan commitment, but you're exhausting your equity before you're collecting draws, right? So there is some risk there, right? That, you know, who knows? I mean, anything could happen. Obviously, they're committed to the project and it makes sense for them at those numbers. But in you know, it's a little bit different than that in a multifamily project, right?
Right.
You're not going to be, maybe the bank requires you to exhaust most of your equity on the you know, value add construction, but you're still getting draws in between. So that's probably a little bit different than what other projects are structured.
So for other sponsors who maybe don't have experience in the build to rent space, but are intrigued by it and interested in it, obviously, you know, coming from an abundance perspective, what are some high level challenges that you think newer operators that want to try to push into the build to rent space should be aware of and watch out for?
Yeah. Well, I think this is just, you know, you'll have other people that disagree, but I do think that in a lot of the larger MSAs, if they're kind of trying to go after, you know, some of those higher, you know, like the Austins of the world, the Phoenix of the world, this kind of major markets would have been really kicking ass over the last 5 years. I think that you can go like a mile and a half down the road and you'll see, you know, a new built to rent project that's not fully stabilized yet. So I feel like the Southeast is kind of the area where there's a lot of growth. The fundamentals are strong. The suburbanization has been going on for a long time. So you're already starting to see a lot of these communities being formed, and it makes sense with the fact that it's become kind of Wall Street's favorite son, and that this is the way that they can get their investors yield, CalPERS and CalSTRS and all the pension funds, that, you know, if we can have people that are buying projects, you know, when you're on your exit in the Southeast and you're able to build with one lower impact fees, lower cost of development on the land, much more favorable development areas. That's where I think that even multifamily developers or multifamily value add guys can come in and really make something happen. I you know, someone that's newer to the game, I would certainly encourage them to get on a team.
Sure.
But the more experienced people sometimes have that idea that all of these, you know, top 10 markets over the last couple of years are going to continue with this growth. And I know that that's not the case, because I invested passively in a couple of deals in Austin that actually did see some rent dip. You know, you remember last cycle, people just started doubling up in some of these places where rents get too high. So I would be really selective about the markets too. And then you might have to change a little bit of your mindset about what is a market that makes sense on the development side. Because remember, you're building out communities that you know, with the affordability gap, people got to be able to afford, you know.
Love it. Is there anything else that I should be asking about this particular project, or, you know, future build-to-rent projects that you guys will be working on that I haven't yet?
No, I don't think so. I think that in general, this is kind of my view, is where we're going. Is I definitely think there's going to be a little bit of a lull in 2023. But I really believe that if people are kind of thinking about this logically, where are we in 5 years? If we are only built, you know, if we only built 500,000 units over the last 2-3 years, and we're ramping up, and we've still got this, whoever you talk to, 2.5 million to 4 million unit, you know, scarcity, where could you see things happening? And you know that there's 3 million millennials come, you know, people are living longer. Doesn't it make sense that people want to live in new stuff with backyards and the tech that they can't get necessarily at some of their older single family homes and in many of the apartment buildings, right? Because they've got somebody above them and below them. So I just think people should look at this, you know, does it make sense or doesn't it? And then kind of go from there.
Yeah, love it. Well, look, this has been a great conversation, Andy. I appreciate you, you know, walking us through how Legacy Acquisitions is structured and how you have joint ventured with other partners with specialties to work on these build-to-rent communities, and also about your journey, you know, forward. You've been in the business for a long time. You've seen some up and downs, and you've worked your way through it. And you have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge to share. And then walking us through this case study of Crest BTR, the 98 unit build-to-rent community in Lafayette, Louisiana. Thanks for walking us through that, shedding some light on that process, how the deals are financed, the type of how the deals are structured, and who the ideal tenant is and the ideal product. I'm sure that's going to change and evolve over time, but it sounds like you guys have a pretty good grip on that. So I just appreciate you walking us through that. Before I let you go, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and learn more about what you have going on?
Yeah, please please go to legacyacquisitions.com. We got a lot of free stuff. You don't have, you know, not a bunch of paywalls and things that you got to fill in. But if you are interested in seeing our deals, those opportunities are there. But I also really love talking with either new people in the business or experienced developers that may never invest a dollar. I just love talking real estate. So you can on our site, you know, schedule a call with me or members of our team, and love to chop it up with you. But yeah, thanks for this opportunity, you know, David.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's been a great conversation. And if the listeners have enjoyed the conversation and you want to connect with Andy and his team, go down in the show notes right now, click on one of those links and connect up there. Andy, again, thanks for coming on. I appreciate your time and I look forward to seeing you in touch down the road.
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey there, before you go, I just want to thank you for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed the episode today, and if you did, please, please, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Those ratings and reviews help us to attract the very best guests, and we want to bring you the best guests in the industry. Also, we're active on social media, so be sure to follow us on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. There you can stay connected with us and up to date on all of our latest content. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, theleadsponsor.com. We've got some free trainings and resources there that will help you grow as a leader and an investor. Again, thank you so much for supporting the show. We'll see you next week.